On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
A very special program for Patriot Day, a reminder of what happened 21 years ago and of the men and the women who responded to that challenge. With us today, we have Suzanne Gordon, who is Senior Policy Analyst at the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute, the author of a number of books, including The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Wounds of War, and her newest book, Our Veterans. She is the co-author, along with Steve Early and Jasper Craven. The book is subtitled Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. It's from Duke University Press. She is a frequent speaker before audiences of veterans and VA staff members, healthcare union members, and healthcare reformers around the country, as well as a source to numerous media outlets, and has been a recipient of the Disabled American Veterans Special Recognition Award for her reporting on veterans' healthcare issues. Suzanne, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
The book has some things about it that were very disturbing to learn. That is the fact that there are issues within designations of types of veterans that are seem to be kind of cavalierly handed out, and these keep certain categories of veterans from getting full benefits and so forth. The one thing that comes ringing through in your book, and I would say this is one thing that we have in common, is that we both think, both really deeply feel, that veterans are entitled to the very best health care that they can receive after their service, and that the government should provide this health care, and that it should be, that VA, rather than being defunded or privatized, should be strengthened, so because it's doing a really good job with the limitations that are built into the system now. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the Veterans Health Administration, which is one of the four sub-agencies in the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's the Veterans Health Administration is the healthcare system that takes care of veterans and provides not just healthcare services, but mental health services, and also homelessness, deals with homelessness, veterans' legal problems. The VA, and it's referred to that VHA, is really, I think, one of the best healthcare systems in the country, which is a fact that, sadly, the VA has chosen not to promote, and that a bunch of people who are interested in destroying Americans' faith in government are eager to promote the opposite view of the VA. But, the 92% of American veterans favor the VA and don't want it to be privatized. And more than that, just reams and reams of scientific studies document that the VA delivers care that is equal to or superior to the private sector. A new study just showed that that was in the British Medical Journal, which is one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, showed that if a veteran goes to a private sector hospital for an emergency versus the VA, they're twice as likely to die in that hospital, and it will cost 21% more. And part of the reason is that the care that the private sector system delivers is fragmented and often favors use of futile, expensive episodic treatments. And no, the VA provides coordinated, integrated care.
The current VA guidelines do not allow certain types of veterans, those who are separated from service in less than honorable situation. That's the official way of putting it. But you point out that sometimes this is not, we tend to think of that as being people that were thieves or drug dealers or something within the military. But as you point out in your book, Our Veterans, sometimes it's just, it is not necessarily only used in situations like that that are dire, but sometimes in other situations too. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's very in the weeds, but there's various categories through which service members are discharged from the military. The one that's reserved for the thieves and murderers is dishonorable discharge, and then there's bad conduct discharge, and those require court martials.
Right.
So those are, you know, that's a really, there are very few people that get those every year. But the more relevant issue is that, and that most people don't know about, is that there's a category called other than honorable and general discharges. And those essentially deny service members the benefits that they were promised when they joined the old voluntary military, like free education and health care. The military had various categories of discharges. The most severe is dishonorable, and that's reserved for people who commit serious crimes, and there has to be a court martial. But there's another form of discharge, which is other than honorable. And that is a very murky discharge that allows the military, as we say in our book, to get rid of service members who are, as some unit commanders or company commanders would call them, problem children. You know, they have mental health problems due to PTSD or military sexual trauma. They may get into fights on the weekend or show up, you know, late for formation several times, and they're not really deployable. And rather than go through the complicated process that takes a very long time of a medical discharge, and therefore these unit commanders have people on their books that can't be deployed and it makes them look bad, they are what's called chaptered out or gotten rid of with this other than honorable discharge, and that denies them education and healthcare benefits. And it's particularly tragic in the healthcare area because a lot of times these people have PTSD, traumatic brain injury, they may have reported military sexual trauma, and they really, really need help from the VA. And there's about 600,000 people since 1980 that have those discharges. Now, the VA could make them more welcome, could let them in. It's a kind of complicated legal argument, but somehow the VA has chosen not to, and more importantly, Congress has not exercised oversight in this area and provided them the funding. So even though there have been petitions made by groups like San Francisco Swords to Plowshares and the Harvard Veterans Legal Clinic to make the VA change its regular internal regulations, they haven't done so a lot because of funding, because they don't have the budget to handle 600,000 extra people. So once again, this comes down to Congress refusing to pay what it costs to care for our veterans.
Now, one of the things that I did not consider, and your book points this out, we're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Suzanne Gordon, who is the co-author with Stephen Early and Jasper Craven of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. It's from Duke University Press. One of the things that you pointed out was something that directly affected me, and that was the end of the draft and the beginning of the all-volunteer service. And the idea was, first of all, we don't have to do the draft thing. And second of all, this will let people who really want to be in the military have an opportunity to be in the military, and it'll make things better. And there were certainly advantages to it, but one of the disadvantages is something that most of us who were of draftable age in the early 70s didn't think about, and that is the fact that fewer and fewer people are choosing to go into the Army, so there's a much smaller group of veterans now than at any time during American history when we were at war. So there are fewer people are doing more fighting for, I think the percentage is about 1%. So we have 1% of the country raises all the food and 1% of the country fights all the wars. And the other 98% go, isn't that nice?
Right. And you know, the draft was ended because of the protests within the military and outside of the military at the Vietnam War, and it was deemed that that was, you know, if you continue conscription, those kinds of protests could continue. And so basically we came up with this all-volunteer army, and mostly the people in it are, you know, it's often called the poverty draft because a lot of people who sign up are from communities of color or poor communities, and they don't have money to go to college and they don't have health care, and so they sign up because they're promised those benefits. And but also I think it creates a real civilian military divide because people who are in the military feel that they are unfairly bearing the burden, which I think is true, of military and political decisions that we should all share in, and we should make those decisions together, and we should share in their consequences. And then, you know, and then tragically, and we saw this in this recent debate about the so-called PACT Act, about helping veterans who experience toxic exposures in a number of areas, including in the United States, like in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, where contaminated water between 1953 and 1987 affected almost a million veterans and civilians. The Congress and the American people, I mean, I think the American people are just kind of unaware of this, but Congress is definitely aware of it, and they just refuse to pay the costs of the consequences of both military service and war. And so, you know, we gladly pay for weapons systems that we don't use or that sometimes don't work, and everybody's very eager to fund the military budget, but when it comes to funding the Department of Veterans Affairs, which is an entirely different agency and has a completely different budget, there's, you know, every single dime is as they say, nickels and dimes, you know, and Congress is very unwilling to pay the money to care for our veterans and their families.
That's another thing. I was surprised, and I guess I should be ashamed of my ignorance in this regard. I've been around long enough, I should have known this, but I figured that Veterans Affairs was part of the Department of Defense because those are their people, and it seems like they should be the ones that get to make those designations and that should come under their budget, but it's not then.
No, it is. And also when somebody acts out or whatever because of bad decisions by the DOD, by the Department of Defense, the VA often pays for that. I mean, it doesn't come out of their budget. It doesn't cost them anything when somebody is denied VA benefits or given VA benefits. And also the VA often gets blamed for the consequences of decisions made by the Department of Defense. For example, in the suicide crisis, the veteran suicide crisis, many veterans have 1.5 times more likely to die by suicide than people in the same age cohort. But the VA is often blamed for, you know, why didn't you stop this veteran from dying by suicide? But the VA didn't send them into a war that might not have been necessary for us to fight, depending on your views. And the VA didn't send them on multiple deployments because Donald Rumsfeld decided that he wanted a lean and mean force and to do more with less, which means that more people did more and DOD spent less money. And, so people have gone on multiple deployments and suffered huge amounts of PTSD or traumatic brain injury. And, you know, they have the equivalent, the mental health equivalent of terminal cancer, you know. And the problem is, you know, we all like to think we can stop every suicide. And there are many suicides that we can stop, but there are some that we can't.
Right.
Because the person has been so badly damaged. And the VA gets blamed for that when the Department of Defense really should be blamed, or Congress, you know. I mean, why have we put people in harm's way, perhaps unnecessarily? I don't think we think enough of the consequences. And, you know, I've been reading the history of World War II, World War I. Every war that everybody fights, everybody's like, oh, it's going to be over in 3 days, three
right.
months, you know. Really? I mean, do we not ever learn? No, I guess we don't.
Apparently not.
I mean, when was the last war that ended in 3 days or 3 months, you know.
Yeah. Well, the Gulf War, but in 1990. Okay. But that was an aberration. I mean, and the problem was, I think, is that people who had not read history or didn't learn history thought, oh, well, that's what war is going to be like from now on. You know, in and out, we'll bomb them to pieces, and they'll give up. And that'll be the end.
Yeah,
we can all go home.
It doesn't work that way.
No, it hardly ever works that way.
The other thing that we look at in our book is service in the military is not only about, you know, sacrifice and service. It's a job.
Right.
Right? You're paid to do a job. You get a salary. I mean, and the Pentagon, unfortunately, is not a very careful, safety-conscious employer. I mean, the burn pits are an example of this. This was entirely avoidable. They hired Keller Brent, you know, KBR, to dispose of this waste, and they did so in a way that was extremely dangerous and jeopardized the lives and health of millions of people, including people, you know, who were never in combat.
Right.
And then you look at you know, there's 126 military bases in the United States that are contaminated, where the water supply is contaminated by, you know, various, I can't even pronounce it, perfluorinated compounds, you
right.
know. Military service members are housed in housing with mold. There's a really serious problem that often is leads to the risk of suicide of service members, because actually they're not paid very well, incurring a lot of debt. And they try to, you know, they encourage this. The military allows these kind of, you know, they allow, for example, car dealership on naval vessels to sell cars to kids who just got into the military 18 and received this huge, you know, many $1,000 bonus. Why don't you get this souped up new car? And then they end up getting these cars and they end up in debt. Then they leave the service in debt. And the other thing that's really interesting about military service is that, you know, most of us in America today need two incomes to make it if we're lucky enough to have a partner, a
right.
husband, a wife. And it's very difficult for a military partner's spouse, if they're married, to have a job because the service members move around so much.
Right.
So it's very hard for them to forge a good career with a good paying job. So there's a terrible problem of debt in the military, and that it also leads people to have higher suicide risk. But, you know, the fact is that a lot of people would think that the Pentagon is a safety conscious employer is kind of an oxymoron because, well, you're going to war, you know, training for war. You know, that's inherently unsafe. Indeed, it is. The things that you can do to make it safer, and you certainly don't need to add problems like contaminated water or moldy housing or burn pits to the already inherent dangers of training for war, even if you never go to war. Because very few people who train for war go into combat.
Right, right. And this also makes me think of something else that you brought up in the book. There are many more women who are involved in the military now than in years past.
Yes.
I mean, during World War II,
yes.
you had the WACs and the WAVES and the SPARs and all of those, but they were always in support situations. They were typists and or maybe nurses and things. In Vietnam, you had nurses, and they were in Korea, they were in dangerous areas. They were close to combat zones serving in MASH units. But you didn't have them as combatants or pilots and so
right.
forth. Now, it's a more dangerous deployments to be a woman in the military, but it's also more complicated because you're surrounded by a bunch of guys, and there doesn't seem to be as much concern over sexual assault as you would hope there would be.
Well, to the contrary, I mean, I would argue that military culture it's very misogynist. I can't use these terms on the radio, but, people are referred to, men are referred to as the P word, you know, if they, I don't know, aren't show any of lack of whatever.
Yeah, yeah. The macho. There is definitely a macho component to being a warrior, and yeah, that goes along with it. But does not bode well for women in the military, because here they are saying, "Hey, I'm tough too," but they are still more vulnerable because they're in they're surrounded and outnumbered.
Yeah, and so it's like, so I think 1 in 4 women in the military has experienced some form of military sexual harassment, all the way from, you know, just pats on the butt and comments to rape and even murder. I mean, mm-hmm. There was a terrible murder of a woman in Fort Hood that was just appalling. Murder and dismemberment. And the military has not, in my view, taken a strong enough action. I mean, when you look at the amount of people, in fact, who have been gotten rid of under, you know, this other than honorable discharge, basically kicked out, it's very hard to prove rape or anything. And in fact, I talked to a young woman that we quote in the book who was assaulted, raped, not just once, but twice, and the rapist got away with it, and she ended up, you know, almost suicidal and leaving the military, and the record is really appalling, and there's a lot that could be done to remedy the situation. I mean, they say they have a zero-tolerance policy, but yet, you know, many women who have reported the assault from a senior officer end up, you know, getting kicked out with these under than honorable discharges. And it's an unacceptable situation. I mean, yes, you know, it's very macho, and, you know, women can be as macho as men and out macho men, you know. I mean, one of the other big problems that of, if we say machismo or whatever you want to call it in the military, is that military service members are really socialized to not seek help for physical or mental problems.
Right.
I mean, some young men have break your leg with a bone sticking out of it for anybody to have any sympathy for you, you know.
Yeah.
And mental health problems are really, really stigmatized. And the military is trying to deal with it, but not effectively enough. And that makes it very difficult for veterans to go for help. You know, men tend to be less medical care seeking than women.
Yes.
But I think in military service members, it's on steroids. And I've talked to guys who've basically sucked it up with horrible PTSD symptoms for decades before they finally went to the VA to get help. And that's another thing. I mean, you know, clearly if you're in the middle of a battle, you sprain your ankle, I mean, you're not going to run to a medic, but you don't have to have this extreme pro-social programming in anti-care-seeking behavior.
One of the things that you talk about at length in the book, and we're getting closer to the end, so I know we can't delve into it as much as it deserves, and that is that irregardless of which party controls the White House or the Congress, it never seems to be much better for the veteran. You point out that there was a Koch Brothers-backed Concerned Veterans of America that was passed some years ago, a couple of presidencies back, that was part of the politicization of the VA and the passage of the Choice Act, which initiated privatizing of VA services. And you consider this a pivotal moment in veterans care, and it certainly seems that way to me, too. Is this act still in force?
But very good question. It's actually gotten worse, because under the Trump administration, the Choice Act was a very limited, and it was supposed to be only 3-year program. But then Trump passed something called the VA Mission Act of 2018, and that really accelerated the outsourcing or the sending out of veterans from the VA to private sector providers. And most of these providers don't know anything about the very specific complex conditions that service members leave the service with. And so, for example, in the Rand Corporation, which is a big corporation that does these scientific studies, studied providers in New York State, healthcare providers in New York State, and they found that only 2% of these providers in a state that has the fifth largest military population in the country, only 2% of those providers were competent to care for military veterans. Most people in the study had no idea about military culture and were not very interested in learning. I mean, they were quite happy to be paid for their services, but they didn't want to learn how to really expertly provide those services to veterans who have very different problems than civilian sector patients.
The Senate recently voted, and of course that's the job of Congress to pass legislation, not the president. The Senate voted to pass the Honoring Our PACT Act, which seeks to broaden coverage for toxic exposure related to burn pits and other things. Has this been passed into law?
The president signed it on Wednesday, August 10th.
Okay.
And I think it's a wonderful thing that it was passed. But the real issue is, will Congress? There's money in the budget for staffing and so forth, but Congress needs to really oversee the VA to make sure that they have the staff, both in the Veterans Benefits Administration and the Veterans Health Administration, to process claims of, potentially 3.5 million veterans and to take care of them. And that's a very big if. We may need more money because these people have, they have mental health problems, they have all kinds of social problems, homelessness. So we need to really be prepared. The fundamental problem here is we really just have to pay the true cost of having an enormous military and the cost of war. And we have to calculate those costs when we make these decisions. I mean, it's kind of like when you buy a house, Like, do you have the money not only to buy the house and pay the mortgage, but do you have money to keep it up over the next 20, 30 years?
Right.
We don't ask those questions. We just kind of blithely hope, that'll be fine. We are a very rich country. We can afford to take care of our veterans and their families. We can afford to expand the VA for all veterans and their families.
It sounds like something that needs to be done, and it needs to be done in a propitious manner as well. I think your book is going to go a long way in opening people's eyes to the disparities and the problems and the fact that the VA desperately needs funding, and Congress can do that. So we need to get a hold of our representatives and our senators and say, we want the VA to have the funding that it needs to take care of the people that have been standing between us and harm's way, and will continue to do so in the future.
Absolutely, and we really need to, if we want to thank veterans for their service, we need to provide them with the benefits and health care that they need, as opposed to just, these routine, words. We have to put our money where our mouth is.
Yes, absolutely. Well said. Suzanne Gordon, our guest today, her new book, along with Steve Early and Jasper Craven, is Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. It's from Duke University Press. You can go to dukeupress.edu. Is there any social media or website designated to this particular book?
Yes, it's ourvetbook.com.
Suzanne Gordon, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for the book. It's fascinating and a little horrifying in places, and we need to be horrified, I think, from time to time when it comes to seeing the reality of things. So thank you for the book, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks again to Suzanne Gordon for joining us for Patriot Day to talk about those that have served in the military, particularly those who have served since that fateful day 21 years ago. Our veterans deserve the best medical care that they can get, mental health as well as physical health. And we can help them by talking to our elected representatives and saying, we want the VA to be better funded. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening. Thank you, veterans, and God bless.